If you enjoy genres like slowcore, post-hardcore, noise rock, math rock, shoegaze, or anything like that, tune into Past Tense 9 p.m. Wednesdays on CFRC. It also airs 9 p.m. Mondays on luradio.ca and 9 p.m. Thursdays on cjlo.com.
Wednesdays at 2 p.m. for the program, when I and host Nate go over a collection of post-punk, post-rock, experimental, electronic, hip-hop, noise, shoegaze, and all types of music, and with a new theme and guest every week. It is the worst show on the radio. I'll see you soon.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This grassroots movement of atomic bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, also known as Hibakusha, is receiving the Peace Prize for its efforts to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons.
A Japanese group of atomic bomb survivors, Nihon Hidankyo, the Hibakusha, has won the Nobel Peace Prize as fears grow of a new nuclear arms race. The head of the group has compared Gaza today to Japan 80 years ago. But first to Lebanon. We'll speak with a doctor who recently worked in Gaza as UN investigators accuse Israel of committing the crime of extermination for relentlessly and deliberately attacking medical personnel and facilities in Gaza. Finally, The Apprentice, the movie Trump doesn't want you to see, opens today in theaters despite legal threats from the former president. The film looks at how Trump was mentored by Roy Cohn, the former chief counsel to Senator Joseph McCarthy during the Red Scare.
Roy Cohn, nice to meet you.
You, Roy Cohn, you're brutal.
Guilty as charged.
I didn't always win.
There's rules. The first rule is attack, attack, attack.
It's going to be the finest building in the city, maybe the country, in the world.
Rule two, admit nothing, deny everything.
We'll speak with the director of The Apprentice, the Iranian-Danish filmmaker Ali Abbasi. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati is calling for a UN resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire as Israel intensifies its assault on Lebanon. Israeli airstrikes Thursday killed at least 22 people and injured more than 100 others in a crowded residential area of central Beirut. Survivors recounted the terror of Israel's overnight strikes as they surveyed the damage to their homes.
I was praying. We heard the first strike, and I thought it was in my house. The second one was much more powerful than the first one. People went down barefoot. They were screaming. We didn't know anything at the start. I went to see where the strike was, and I saw that in my house, the glass and windows had shattered. We came and saw this scene. It was a horrifying scene. It was something unbelievable.
Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned multiple targeted shootings of UN peacekeepers by Israel in southern Lebanon. At least two peacekeepers, Indonesian, have been injured. Such attacks violate international law. A UN official warned the safety of more than 10,400 peacekeepers in Lebanon was, quote, increasingly in jeopardy, unquote, from Israel's attacks. This is Andrea Tenenti, spokesperson for the UN Interim Force in Lebanon.
We are there because the Security Council has asked us to be there. So we are staying until the situation becomes impossible for us to operate. This is not a conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. This is becoming a regional conflict, something that we have been saying for a very long time. And if it's a regional conflict, everybody will be involved. So it's a duty for everyone to stop it, because we already seen just in the last few weeks how many people have been killed here, more than the conflict in 2006, in just a few weeks.
This comes amidst fresh warnings of a deteriorating health crisis in Lebanon due to massive displacement and the Israeli targeting of health facilities and workers. After headlines, we'll speak with a U.S. doctor in Beirut who's been volunteering in Gaza and Lebanon. In Gaza, medical authorities report Israeli attacks killed at least 63 Palestinians Thursday as Israel continues its siege of the northern Gaza Strip. The situation at three hospitals in northern Gaza remains critical as medical workers struggle to respond to forced expulsions ordered by Israel. Dr. Hassam Abu Safia, director of Kamel Adwan Hospital, filmed this video from inside the intensive care unit Thursday.
We're here under threat because our hospital will go out of service due to the continuous threats to evacuate the hospital and due to the lack of entry of fuel to the Kamel Adwan Hospital. From here, from the middle of the intensive care unit, I call on all the international organizations and humanitarian organizations and the international community to stop the occupiers from implementing their decision to evacuate the Kamel Adwan Hospital and seizing its services. Stopping the Kamel Adwan Hospital from providing services means the ending of these children's lives.
A United Nations commission has concluded for the second time this year Israel's, quote, committing war crimes and the crime against humanity of extermination with relentless and deliberate attacks on medical personnel and facilities, unquote. In related news, the Belgium-based Hindrejab Foundation this week filed what it called an unprecedented and historic complaint with the International Criminal Court against 1,000 Israeli soldiers for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in Gaza. Al Jazeera says its camera operator, Fedi Ouahidi, remains in critical condition after he was shot in the neck by an Israeli sniper while reporting from Jabalia. It's been a bloody week for media workers in Gaza. Journalist Omar Abalawi, who was also a celebrated teacher to Gaza's children, was shot and killed by Israeli forces, also in Jabalia Wednesday. Over the past year, Abalawi kept his beloved English classes going amidst displacement, the destruction of his home, and the death of his family members. In Israel, a court reportedly ordered the release of U.S. journalist Jeremy Lofredo after he was detained earlier this week and held on alleged, quote, suspicion of serious security offenses, unquote, after he reported on Iran's ballistic missile attacks on military and intelligence sites in Israel. Three other journalists were also detained with Lofredo, but released soon after. Lofredo is reportedly being barred from leaving Israel for now. A Ukrainian journalist who went missing more than a year ago while reporting from eastern Ukraine has died in Russian custody. Victoria Rozhina last made contact with her editors in August of 2023 while reporting from the Russian-occupied Zaporizhia region. Her father says he received notice she died in a Russian prison September 19th and that her body would be returned to Ukraine. No other details of her death were provided. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports at least 16 media workers have been killed covering the war in Ukraine since Russia's invasion in 2022. In Florida, more than 2.5 million customers remain without power this morning as the damage from Hurricane Milton became clearer. At least 16 people killed, widespread wind and water damage to homes and businesses, and severe levels of erosion that will permanently alter Florida's coastline. The Fitch Ratings Group warns Milton could cause Florida property owners up to $50 billion in insured losses. This is Calvin Lee Hamilton, a resident of St. Lucie County on Florida's Atlantic coast, where tornadoes spawned by Milton tore through a retirement community, killing six people.
I try to get prepared for the hurricane, then the tornado hit. I'm like, the tornado hit before the hurricane. This is a double disaster.
In Colombia, election officials have requested an investigation into the 2022 campaign of President Gustavo Petro over alleged violations of financing limits. Officials are also accusing Petro of receiving funds from, quote, prohibited sources of financing. President Petro has denied the accusations and warned of a plot to remove him from power through the courts. In Haiti, heavily armed gunmen invaded the coastal town of Arakahe on Thursday, burning homes and firing on residents. The attack came just 1 week after gang members massacred at least 115 people in the nearby town of Pontsande. Over 700,000 people have been displaced by gang violence in Haiti, triggering the largest food crisis in the Western Hemisphere, with over 5 million Haitians, nearly half the population, going hungry. Earlier today, Kenya's President William Ruto met with Haitian Prime Minister Garry Conille in Nairobi. After the talks, Ruto said he would send another 600 police officers to Haiti to bolster a Kenyan-led, UN-authorized mission to fight Haitian gangs. A new report from the United Nations Children's Agency finds one out of every eight girls alive today, some 370 million people, will experience rape or sexual assault before they turn 18. That shocking figure is even worse for girls living in so-called fragile settings like refugee camps or conflict zones, where one in four face sexual violence. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell called the findings a stain on our moral conscience and warned rape and gender-based violence are often used as weapons of war. Here in the United States, the Justice Department says TD Bank will pay more than $3 billion in fines after pleading guilty to federal money laundering charges. Two TD Bank employees have also been criminally charged. Federal prosecutors say TD Bank became the go-to institution for narco-traffickers and human smugglers, including one case where workers received tens of thousands of dollars in gift cards as bribes from a man who laundered more than $470 million in illicit funds through TD Bank branches here in the United States. In Texas, two people were killed and nearly three dozen treated for chemical exposure Thursday following a leak of toxic hydrogen sulfide gas at a Houston-area oil refinery operated by Pemex, the Mexican state-owned petroleum company. Authorities issued a shelter-in-place order for Deer Park and neighboring Pasadena for several hours, telling residents to seal doors and windows and turn off air conditioners. Thursday's disaster comes less than a month after hundreds of Deer Park families were forced to evacuate their homes after a pipeline explosion sent a massive column of fire and toxic smoke into the sky. In Ithaca, New York, a PhD student is no longer at risk of deportation for his Gaza solidarity activism after Cornell allowed him to re-enroll, thereby extending his visa. Cornell had suspended Mamadou Tal for participating in a campus protest calling on Cornell to divest from Israel, but a public pressure campaign demanded the Ivy League school end their political campaign against Tal. In a statement, Mamadou Tal said, quote, "I have no regrets. There will never come a time where I will say to myself that I went too hard for Gaza. We still haven't done near enough to stop the genocide," he said. Students are continuing to organize across college campuses with protest vigils and other actions under the banner of a week of rage to mark 1 year of war against Gaza. And the 2024 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the Japanese group Nihon Hidankyo, a grassroots group of atomic bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The anti-nuclear activists known as Hibakusha, atomic bomb survivors, are being recognized for their, quote, efforts to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons and for demonstrating through witness testimony that nuclear weapons must never be used again, unquote. After the prize was announced, the co-chair of Nihon Hidankyo, Toshiyuki Mimaki, spoke to reporters in Tokyo and said, quote, "In Gaza, bleeding children are being held by their parents. It's like in Japan 80 years ago." We'll have more on this year's Nobel Peace Prize later in the broadcast. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A team of United Nations experts has accused Israel of committing war crimes and the crime of extermination for its, quote, relentless and deliberate attacks on medical personnel and facilities, unquote. This comes as medical authorities in Gaza report Israel has killed at least 63 more Palestinians amidst an intensifying siege on the northern Gaza Strip. The situation at three hospitals in northern Gaza remains critical as medical workers struggle to respond to forced expulsions ordered by Israel. The director of Khan al-Adwan Hospital, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, filmed this video from inside the intensive care unit on Thursday.
We're here under threat because our hospital will go out of service due to the continuous threats to evacuate the hospital and due to the lack of entry of fuel to the Khan al-Adwan Hospital. From here, from the middle of the intensive care unit, I call on all the international organizations and humanitarian organizations and the international community to stop the occupiers from implementing their decision to evacuate the Khan al-Adwan Hospital and seizing its services. Stopping the Khan al-Adwan Hospital from providing services means the ending of these children's lives.
We're joined right now by Dr. Bing Li, an emergency medicine physician based in Arizona, who worked at the Indonesian hospital in the north of Gaza as a volunteer with Rama Worldwide. Dr. Li is a U.S. Army veteran. She's joining us now from Beirut, Lebanon, where she's working to increase healthcare capacities as a volunteer with Med Global. Dr. Bing Li, thank you so much for being with us. If you can start on the situation in Gaza.
Thank you, Amy. So the situation, especially in North Gaza, has been incredibly heartbreaking for those of us that volunteered and met many of the people that work in North Gaza in these three hospitals. And for me, at Indonesian Hospital, where I spent 2 weeks, these people that chose to stay in North Gaza, the doctors, the nurses, the administrators, even the janitors, they stayed because they knew that they needed to be there for their patients. They are the most impressive people, the most courageous, and the most principled people that I have ever met. And it has been incredibly hard to hear their stories right now. They are people that never complain, that have unlimited patience, that showed us generosity. Usually when I ask them, how are you doing? Are you okay? They always say, thank God, I am fine. There's no complaint. The other day, one of them reached out to me to ask how I was doing because of the hurricanes, and he was concerned that in the U.S. that it wasn't safe because of these hurricanes that are happening. And what is happening now, this is the first time that I have heard many of these people be concerned to show complaints. The medical director at Indonesian Hospital, he says that there are over 40 patients that are trapped inside the hospital, that it is unsafe for them to go anywhere, unsafe for them to step outside to try to evacuate these patients. They are running out of food, running out of water. There already was such a limited amount of medical supplies and medications during the time that we were working there in June, and those are now running out. They're running out of fuel for electricity, for the ventilators that keep patients breathing on machines. There are 17 staff that are trapped with them that are just doing daily what they can. They've been trapped now for 5 days, unable to leave the hospital. And the other doctors are unable to come in to relieve them because one of them told me he was trying to travel to the hospital to be there. And in front of him, he saw an ambulance get struck by a missile. And so it was unsafe for him to continue passing. They tell me that it feels like death is everywhere. The smell of death is everywhere. They have nowhere safe to go. One of the medical students, a 20-year-old who has been that worked every day very hard, always trying to take care of patients, he's telling me that his family has been displaced now 4 times in the past 3 days, that there are bombs going off constantly around them in the homes next door. They're not sure where they might go next.
Let me ask you about...
Let me ask you about
the group Medical Aid for Palestinians, who says it's removed newborn babies from Khan al-Adwan, but that ambulances are being detained at military checkpoints as they attempt to reach Gaza City. The humanitarian group warned the world must act before Gaza is erased entirely. Now, Dr. Bing Li, you did not work at Khan al-Adwan, but it was your referral center for OBGYN and pediatric cases. Your response to this news of the infants?
This is incredibly concerning. We must remember that when we say that a hospital, especially in North Gaza, is being told to evacuate, it's not the same as you're going from one hospital that is fully functional to another hospital that is fully functional, because the healthcare system has been devastated to this extent. Both Khan al-Adwan Hospital and Indonesian Hospital, they have been forced to close multiple times. not only have they been directly hit by bombs, but then they are occupied by a ground invasion, and so it becomes unsafe to continue to operate. And then what is impressive is that the healthcare administrators, the healthcare leaders come together and they open up these hospitals in 1 week, in 2 weeks' time. When we arrived at Indonesian hospital, they were able to open up two floors, the ER and the surgical floor, within 2 weeks of the occupying force having left. So with this piecemeal way that people are coming together and making things work, we rely on these different hospitals to work together. So Kamal Adwan Hospital was the only hospital that was receiving pediatric patients that could take very sick patients into their ICU. They have a nutrition center to help the extremely malnourished children that can't be released, that would die without IV support and die without hospital nutritional support. And they also took in the OB patients, the pregnant women, and the neonatal patients. So as an ER physician, it's very concerning to me to hear that there are children that are this young, that are babies, infants, that are being told they need to evacuate to be transported to other facilities, because I think this is impossible. There's nowhere else for them to go. This was the only facility that was in that area. And I know that the UN forces and the Palestinian Red Crescent that has been trying to get up to that area to try to evacuate these patients, they've not been allowed through. Another point that many people do not realize when they hear about North Gaza and South Gaza is that they are completely divided. It is about as hard to get from outside Gaza into South Gaza as it is to get from South Gaza to North Gaza. There's a whole new border, a whole military blockade between the North and the South, and that is why we say that it's different. Virtually no aid, virtually no help is allowed into North Gaza at this time. And so these children that are being told to evacuate, these patients, there simply isn't the infrastructure, there isn't the equipment present and the safety present for them to go anywhere, for them to be put on an ambulance and safely be transported to another facility that doesn't exist. It's essentially a death sentence for these infants, for these very young children that need a high level of care, that need ICU levels of care.
This is the director of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Ramesh Rajasingham.
Critical items are awaiting approval for entry. Our access is restricted. For example, yesterday, OCHA and the World Health Organization tried to reach northern Gaza to support the Kamal Adwan Hospital after Israeli authorities offered its immediate evacuation. And after receiving a green light from the Israeli authorities for the mission, the team was forced to wait at a holding point for hours, and ultimately the mission had to be aborted. And that's not an unusual practice. In September, less than 10% of coordinated missions to the north were facilitated by the Israeli authorities.
So that's the director of UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Ramesh Rajasingham. Dr. Bingley, if you can respond to that. And also, the UN chief, Antonio Guterres, saying he's written directly to the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, warning him against dismantling the UN agency tasked with providing food and health care and social services to Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Two bills under consideration in Israel's parliament would prevent UNRWA from continuing its essential work. Guterres said passage of the legislation would be a catastrophe in what's already an unmitigated disaster. As you worked in these hospitals in the north and south of Gaza, the role of UNRWA in helping them?
So it's extremely, extremely alarming that already when we're working in these hospitals, there's already so little aid, so little supplies that are coming in. To take away what little is left is essentially, again, a death sentence for anybody there who requires medical care, who requires this kind of help. When we were working in North Gaza, already in South Gaza, I spent 2 weeks in the south when we first arrived. It's already a very difficult place to work. It's already overburdened. There's already very few supplies. And then when you go to the north, there's even a fraction of that. And I'm not surprised that the border has been difficult, that aid hasn't been getting through, because I know we waited for hours both ways to be able to allow it through. It's extremely difficult for medical aid, for these teams to make it through. I think we were the first team in many months to make it to that area of the north. And to dismantle UNRWA, which is the main support, the main lifeline for these Palestinians, even before the war, They were the ones that fed 50% of the population, provided services, provided education. It's just another example of the violation of humanitarian law and these humanitarian rights.
Dr. Bingley, I want to get to Lebanon. We only have a few minutes where you are right now. Interestingly, you worked at Indonesian Hospital, which was originally set up by Indonesia for Gaza. And in the south of Lebanon, the two UN peacekeepers who were shot, who were injured, are Indonesian UN peacekeepers in southern Lebanon. But you're in central Beirut, where a mass explosion rocked the city. Dozens of people were killed, more than 100 injured. Can you describe the situation on the ground there?
So a lot of anxiety, a lot of families that don't know what is going to happen next, where they should go, if they should try to stay. I'm here with Med Global at the moment, and we're helping to build the healthcare capacity of Lebanon. I'm working with the Ministry of Public Health to try to bring in more supplies to help support the capacity of some hospitals that have been identified as those that will be most helpful in case these crises continue to happen, in case there continue to be mass casualties. And when this blast in Beirut happened, I was actually in Sidon, which is in Saida, which is south, maybe about an hour south of Beirut, and talking to hospitals about their needs, doing needs assessments, and seeing what kind of services we can provide to those hospitals.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, emergency medicine physician based in Arizona who worked at the Indonesian hospital in the north of Gaza and is volunteer with Rama Worldwide. She's now in Beirut, Lebanon, volunteering with Med Global. Dr. Lee is a U.S. Army veteran. Coming up, the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded to a Japanese group of atomic bomb survivors. The head of the group has said, Gaza today looks like Japan 80 years ago. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, the 2024 Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to the Japanese group Nihon Hidankyo, a grassroots organization of survivors of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and Nagasaki 3 days later on August 9, 45. The survivors of the only two nuclear bombs ever used in conflict went on to dedicate their lives to struggle for a nuclear-free world for nearly 8 decades. Known as Hibakusha, the atomic bomb survivors are being recognized for, quote, demonstrating through witness testimony that nuclear weapons must never be used again. The Nobel Committee noted the taboo against nuclear weapons use now, quote, was now under pressure. This is Nobel Committee Chair Jürgen Wagner Friednes.
Next year will mark 80 years since two American atomic bombs killed an estimated of 120,000 inhabitants of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A comparable number died of burn and radiation injuries in the months and years that followed. Today's nuclear weapons have far greater destructive power. They can kill millions and would impact the climate catastrophically. A nuclear war could destroy our civilization.
After the Nobel Peace Prize was announced, the co-chair of Nihon Hidankyo, Toshiyuki Mimaki, spoke to reporters in Tokyo.
What? Nihon Hidankyo?
How did Nihon Hidankyo? It can't be real. It can't be real. We will appeal to the world, as we always have done, for the abolition of nuclear weapons and the achievement of an everlasting peace. Why Nihon Hidankyo? I thought for sure it would be the people working so hard in Gaza, as we've seen.
That was Toshiyuki Mimaki, the co-chair of Nihon Hidankyo, which won the 2024 Nobel Peace Prize today. He wept as he spoke. He went on to say, quote, in Gaza, bleeding children are being held by their parents. It's like in Japan 80 years ago. For more, we go to Boston, where we're joined by Joseph Gerson, longtime peace and disarmament activist who has worked closely with Nihon Hidankyo for the past 40 years, president of the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security, former vice president. President of the International Peace Bureau and worked with AFSC. We welcome you to Democracy Now! In a moment, we're going to hear from Habakasha. But can you talk about the significance, Joe, of this group being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, I think there are two things to say. First of all, the courage of these people is staggering. I mean, to understand that the situation that they faced, literal hell, I mean, the descriptions of people that I know who, suffered burns, saw people with their eyeballs hanging out, ghosts, the whole city destroyed in an instant. I mean, these people literally survived hell, and they turned their experiences, their suffering, into what Wilfred Burchett, the first Western journalist to go into Hiroshima, later described as the most important force for the abolition of nuclear weapons among humanity. And then to say that it could not come at a better time. What most people don't understand is the increasing danger of nuclear war at this point. Not only in Ukraine, also especially as the United States and China confront one another. The reality that among all the nuclear powers, the threshold for nuclear use is decreasing, and all of the nuclear powers are in the process of so-called modernizing their nuclear arsenals. This is a very dangerous moment, and what the Nobel Committee has done has been in a way to answer the Oppenheimer film. We must, as the Habakasha say, recognize that human beings and nuclear weapons cannot coexist, and we have to work for their abolition.
And very interesting that the head of the group said he compared Gaza today to Japan after the atomic bombing and the threats of Israel to perhaps blow up a nuclear site in Iran. I wanted to go back to 2016, when Democracy Now! Spoke to Setsuko Thurlow, a survivor of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima in 1945. She is a member of Nihon Hidankyo.
I was a 13-year-old grade 8 student at the girls' school, and I was mobilized by the Army, together with a group of about 30 schoolmates, and we were trained to act as a decoding assistants. And that very day, being Monday, we were to start the day's work as a full-fledged decoding assistant. At 8 o'clock, we had the morning assembly, and the Major Yanai gave us a pep talk. And we said, we will do our best for Emperor's sake. And at that moment, I saw the bluish-white flash in the windows. I was on the second floor of the wooden building, which was 1 mile or 1.8 kilometer away from the ground zero. And after seeing the flash, I had a sensation of floating in the air. All the buildings were flattened by the blast and falling. And obviously, the building I was in was falling, and my body was falling together with it. That's the end of my recollection. Then I regained my consciousness, and when I regained, I found myself in a total darkness and the silence. I tried to move my body, but I couldn't. So I knew I was faced with death. I thought, finally, Americans got us. Then I started hearing the whispering voices of my classmates who were around me in the same room. Mother, help me. God, help me. And all of a sudden, strong male voice said, don't give up. I'm trying to free you. Keep moving. Keep pushing. And you see the sunray coming through that opening. Get moving toward that direction. Crawl. And that's what I did in the total darkness. I didn't see anything. But by the time I came out, the building was on fire. That meant all my classmates who were with me, about 30 of them, were burned to death alive. And two other girls managed to come out. Three of us looked around outside. And although it happened in the morning, it was dark, dark as twilight. And as our eyes got used to recognize things, those dark moving objects happened to be human beings. It was like a procession of ghosts. I say ghosts because they simply did not look like human beings. Their hair was rising upwards, and they were covered with blood and dirt, and they were burned and blackened and swollen. Their skin and flesh were hanging, and parts of the bodies were missing. Some were carrying their own eyeballs, and as they collapsed onto the ground, their stomach burst open and the intestines started stretching out.
That was Setsuko Thurlow speaking on Democracy Now! In 2016, a survivor of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima, also a member of Nihon Hidankyo, which just won the Nobel Peace Prize. She's lived in Canada for decades. She is well over 90 years old. Thanks so much to Joseph Gerson, president of the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security, and former vice president of the International Peace Bureau. Coming up, The Apprentice, the movie Trump doesn't want you to see. Stay with us. Tears Are Spilling by the Japanese musician Ryoko Moriyama. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to what Variety magazine has called the most controversial movie of the year, and what Salon calls the movie Trump doesn't want you to see. The Apprentice is a new biopic about Donald Trump's rise to fame in the 80s and his close relationship with Roy Cohn, who served as a chief counsel to Senator Joseph McCarthy during the Red Scare of the 1950s. Earlier this year, lawyers for Trump attempted to block screenings of the film, claiming the movie is a, quote, concoction of lies that repeatedly defames President Trump. Despite the threats, the film is opening in New York today. This is a trailer for The Apprentice.
Yes.
Hello. This is Donald Trump from Mr. Cohn. Thank you so much.
Donald who?
1, 2, 3, 4!
Roy Cohn. Nice to meet you.
You, Roy Cohn, you're brutal.
Guilty as charged.
I didn't always win.
His rules. The first rule is attack, attack, attack.
It's going to be the finest building in the city. Maybe the country. In the world.
Rule two, admit nothing, deny everything.
There's never been anything like this, of this magnitude, this quality.
Ooh, cheese balls over here.
What are you doing?
You want one?
No, it looks totally disgusting.
Cheese balls.
Rule three, no matter what happens, you claim victory and never admit defeat.
You have to be willing to do anything to anyone to win.
You have a big ass. You gotta work on that.
Your face looks like an orange.
Attack, attack, attack.
Deny everything.
Admit nothing.
Never admit defeat.
What if you lost your fortune today?
Well, then maybe I'll run for president. I don't know.
I say if you're indicted, you're invited.
The trailer for the new film, The Apprentice, a dramatized portrayal of Donald Trump's close relationship with Roy Cohen in the 1980s. Roy Cohen, chief counsel to McCarthy, also largely responsible for the execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in 1953. We're joined now by the award-winning Iranian-Danish filmmaker Ali Abbasi, who directed The Apprentice, which premiered earlier this year at the Cannes Film Festival. His previous films include Holy Spider, set in Tehran, and Border, set in around Stockholm. Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I spoke to Ali earlier this week and asked him about why he decided to focus on Roy Cohen and Donald Trump in this film.
For me, The Apprentice is not a Trump biopic as such. It's about a, you know, transformative relationship of him and the mentorship of Roy Cohen. It's sort of a buddy movie for two villains, if you like, or two superheroes, or, you know, two anti-heroes, whichever way you want to look at it. And, you know, Roy was a wonderfully colorful character. He was, as you were mentioning, Joseph McCarthy's right-hand man, you know, was sort of a legal wonder kid coming, like, I think it was like 21, 22 when he joined the legal team of Joseph McCarthy and was very instrumental in sort of persecuting this whole sort of the Red Scare. And after that, actually, you know, he was also involved in Lavender Scare, which was persecuting homosexuals in federal government, himself being a closeted gay man. Anyways, later in '60s, you know, he starts this law practice in New York, but what he really does there, he becomes sort of a fixer and a socialite where he connects people. He has immense political power. You know, he's good friends with Richard Nixon. You know, he knows a lot of people. He, you know, at some point he's repping all the five mob families in New York at the same time, you know, and Andy Warhol and people from Studio 54 and celebrities and politicians and you name it. And I think that he was also a PR genius. You know, he was extremely good at sort of getting hang of, you know, media. Everyone, all the reporters loved him. You know, he was, you know, very good at getting stuff out there. And he was the person who sort of built Trump, you know, as a person, as a brand, as an identity from ground up, in a way. And you know, taught him to create his own reality when he needed.
I mean, you also said about the film that it's also it's about the American system.
That's
a
right.
System that allowed someone like Roy Cohen to operate in the way that he did. So was there something about the system that you wanted to convey in the film?
Yeah. Look, I'm born and raised in Iran, and as such, I have this sort of outside view of the American politics and justice and legal system. And I think, you know, this system was not created by Donald Trump. It wasn't created even by Roy Cohen. This system is in place, and these people are very good at navigating it. This is a system where, you know, you can, you know, bury people with legal firepower if you have enough money. You can, you know, pull different strings. You can, almost buy votes. You know, at the same time, it is not. It is a democracy, but it's a, flawed democracy, which makes it like full of different loopholes and different like backdoors and whatnot. And I think these people were experts in using those loopholes and using those sort of, you know, corners and fringes to get what they want from the system. At the same time, you know, we're the whole sort of American society as such is based also on this social Darwinism, you know, which is, you know, winner takes it all, and if either you're a killer or you're killed. And that sort of ideological backbone is there, you know. You can see it with Donald, you can see it with Roy, you can see it with Fred Trump, who was Donald's dad, you know. He wanted his sons and, you know, children to become killers, you know.
And speaking of which, in terms of the film, the attempted killing of the film, Cannes Film Festival, 11-minute standing ovation, but also a legal letter from the Trump campaign team. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, we got a. It didn't take long. And we got this cease and desist letter. And basically, what it says is, you know, if you attempt to distribute this rubbish and whatnot, and try to interfere in our election with foreign money and, you know, a guy from Iran and, you know, all the sort of, it wasn't really addressed to me or Gabe as much as it was addressed
to
Gabe Sherman, right? It was more, I guess, addressed to his base, you know, in a way. So you know, but the threat is there, and we'll see in a few days what's come out of it.
Let's go to a clip of The Apprentice.
You want to know how to win? I'm going to let you in on a little secret. There's rules. Roy Cohn's three rules of winning.
The first rule is the simplest. Attack, attack, attack.
Civil rights, cats.
I hope the pots you're stuffing's got real money, because after I get you fired, you're sure going to need it.
Excuse me?
Unless you drop your baseless litigation, I am countersuing the Justice Department for
$100 million, and you are going to rue the day that you ever filed this.
Who is this?
It's Roy Cohn calling on behalf of my client, Donald J. Trump.
And this is another clip from The Apprentice in which Trump's being interviewed over the phone as he rides in the back of the car with Roy Cohn, who's advising him what's to say.
Listen, Judy, about 100 reporters were crawling up my to get this interview, and I gave you the exclusive.
Yes, hello, Judy. This is Donald Trump. Very excited to talk to you.
Be excited.
Donald, now that the lawsuit is behind you, what do you want to do next?
Well, I intend to acquire the Commodore, and I'm planning on making it the best and the finest building in the city, maybe the country. In the world, Judy, in the world, it's going to be the finest building in the world. It's going to be a spectacular hotel, absolutely spectacular, first class, and...
That sounds very ambitious. Where do you get the drive? Still so young, Donald.
I got flair, and I'm smart, so I think that's going to make me successful. But I also want to stay humble.
Sorry, Judy. Listen, let's do the rest in person and bring a photographer, okay?
Sorry, Roy.
It's your life. You got a ways to go, but you're learning.
So those are clips from your really magnificent film, The Apprentice, which will open Friday here in New York. So, I mean, you know, one of the things that's so interesting and well done in the film is precisely this relationship, the relationship between Roy Cohn and Trump. So if you could say, what most surprised you when you were working with a journalist, Gabriel Sherman, who's written about Trump for decades in writing the screenplay, what most surprised you in what you discovered about Roy Cohn independently and Trump independently, but also about their relationship, which is really what the film tracks from beginning to end?
Look, these people, they've been depicted, you know, many times, you know, Mr. Trump, obviously, in many different, you know, sketches and you know, satire, and you know, they've been sort of laughed at and villainized and you know, and you have Angels in America, where Roy is a major character. I think what we tried to do here, which we, you know, differently in a way, was to try to focus on their humanity. You know, we try to deal with them as human beings. You know, who have real pain, real feelings, real pleasure. You know, and I think that's where the surprising part is actually. Mm-hmm. You know, that someone like Roy Cohn, being the person he was, you know, being a pretty malicious political operative, among other things, also could recite, you know, classic Persian poetry, you know, from 1,000 years ago. Also, you know, was generous to his friends and loyal, you know. And same goes with Mr. Trump, you know. But everyone said, okay, you know, when we were doing the movie, that, you know, all my liberal friends was like, you know, we can't believe that he has feelings. We can't believe that he ever get affected. And one of the things I you know, when I was reading about it, you know, the interesting thing is, for example, his relationship with his brother, Freddie, who sort of got crushed by their dad, you know, and by the pressure he put on him to become killers. And I think that really affected Donald, you know, really affected his relationship with alcohol, you know, because Freddie died of alcoholism. And, you know, there's real feeling and real trauma there. So if you dig a little bit under the surface, you find real emotions and real feelings, real human beings. At the same time, they are these two, like, relentless opportunists. You know, you can see it even in their own relationship. There's always been love and affection and real sort of loyalty. At the same time, as Roy at the end was, you know, sick and you know, was dying of AIDS and got disbarred, and Mr. Trump didn't really have a use for him. He was distancing himself from him, you know, because also, like, his image projection of, like, this macho image, the WWF guy or whatever in the 80s, you know, that was in contrast with like, having a, you know, a person with friends with AIDS, you know?
I wanted to go back to when Roy Cohn was his lawyer.
Right.
This is the early 70s when Donald is working with his father, Fred Trump, and the DOJ, the Department of Justice, sues them for racial discrimination, preventing people of color, primarily African Americans, from living in their housing developments in Queens. This clip begins with Roy Cohn speaking in court as Trump's defense attorney.
Objection. The Civil Rights Division did not file a lawsuit. Frankly, it compiled a 48-page press release, as far as I can tell. Now, the government has failed to spell out one single fact concerning alleged discriminatory practices against blacks by the Trumps. I motion to have this case dismissed on summary judgment.
Overruled. Counselor, continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Agent Green, what led you to believe that you were denied a lease at Trump Properties based on your race?
Well, not only did the newspaper advertise...
That's Walter, DOJ. He runs the show.
I saw three Caucasian couples approved before.
Objection, speculation.
Mr. Cohn.
How can you say for sure
Mr.
they were
Cohn,
Caucasian?
Please allow Agent Green to answer the question.
I've seen Puerto Ricans whiter than my tush after a long run.
That's a clip from The Apprentice, and it talks about this really, you know, horrific time as they're gaining their wealth, where they are preventing people of color from getting into their housing development. But talk about why this was so seminal for you, Roy Cohn representing Trump.
This was how they met. You know, DOJ had a really good case, actually, you know, and, you know, they marked, you know, black applicants with a C. That's actually from the you know, the case. So it was sort
C
of
for
colored. So this was sort of beyond reasonable doubt, you can say. And, you know, you can, again, you can look at reality in two ways. You can say, oh, the Trumps are racist, whatnot. You can also say a lot of people with the same kind of property and same kind of wealth, they just didn't want, you know, people of color or working class people or problems. And these were one of them, you know. Whichever way you look at it, it was problematic. DOJ had a good, really good case, and everyone was telling them, you know, you have to settle, you have to, you know, you have to give up. And then he sort of bumped into Roy, and Roy was the only person who said, no, we're going to, you know, countersue the government, of course. You know, we're going to go on attack, which they did, you know, on, with him. And they settled out of court with not almost no even a slap on the wrist. You know, they got sort of this sort of symbolic program and, you know. And that's where I think Donald saw the power of Roy Cohn, and that's how their mentorship started, actually.
So I want to go back to what you were talking about earlier, which is that, you know, there have been many depictions of Roy Cohn. There have been many depictions, obviously many more, of Trump. But what this film does differently, and it does do it differently, is it makes them full characters, right? So you see them also in an empathetic light.
That's right.
Do you think, and earlier you mentioned that you're an outsider to the U.S. You've lived in Tehran, you've lived in Stockholm, and now you're settled in Copenhagen. Do you think your being an outsider is what enabled you to see them and their relationship in that light, in a way that they have not been represented in American depictions, let's say?
I certainly think it helped because I don't have the same, you know, I don't have a horse in this race. You know, I'm not Democrat, I'm not Republican. I don't have an interest as such in the party politics. So I look at it as people and relationships in a relatively neutral way as such. Now, that doesn't mean, like, value-wise, I think everything's neutral and there are good people on both sides. I don't believe that, you know. But as so far as the story goes and the characters, yes, I can. I think I can investigate that and not be sort of, intimidated by, you know, this side or other side, not to be, you know, not to be thinking so much of who would love this, who would hate this.
And you, as an Iranian filmmaker who's done such exceptional work in the past, your view growing up of the United States and what happened before and after the Iranian Revolution of 1979?
Right. I mean, we used to be an American colony, basically, you know, before 79. And that overnight—
With the U.S. supporting the Shah.
Yeah. And, you know, not only supporting, but also culturally, economically, you know, it was much deeper than supporting just the Shah. And then after that, that changed overnight, you know, and we became sort of arch enemy of U.S. And growing up in that and growing up in that environment, you sort of have this sort of negative space that is inhibited by the great Satan, America, as the Islamic Republic was calling it. So you cannot help by being, engaged or interested in U.S. politics, you know. But also, I think, as someone who grew up in the Middle East, you know, one thing that our experience, at least talking for myself, is there is not a huge difference between a Democratic president and a Republican president. There's not a, you know, we feel like the bombs are going to drop anyways. We're going to get the short end of the stick anyways. And I think that sort of neutralizes this debate a little bit, you know, which is interesting because when you look at the sort of, you know, both the Democrats and Republicans, they try to create this inevitability of the other side being the villain, the other side would destroy this country and all that. But if you look at it, Fred Trump, his dad, Donald's dad, lifelong Democrat, Democratic donor, Roy Cohn, Democrat. Mr. Trump himself, a relatively, say, pro-abortion Democrat, gone to an anti-abortion Republican. What does that tell you about the U.S. political system?
And, of course, Roy Cohn was the ally of the Wisconsin Republican hate-monger Joe McCarthy, though he survives when Joe McCarthy ultimately takes on the army and dies. But also in the execution of the Rosenbergs, that comes up a few times in your film. And for people who aren't familiar with what happened on June 21st, 1953, and Roy Cohn's role in that.
That's right, because he was instrumental in getting Rosenbergs executed. And, you know,
Ethel and Julius.
And there are different accounts, you know, as like how guilty they were and of their charges, espionage. But I think the accounts are sort of people generally agree that Julius might have been guilty, but Ethel wasn't really, you know, guilty, or if she was, she wouldn't be guilty of execution, at least. That much is, I think, pretty well known and accepted. And I think Roy really pushed for them to be executed and to make a statement. And you know, basically manipulated the whole legal system and the judge and all that. And that's a really good example of what kind of person he was as a political operative. And again, this is a tradition, sort of, in a way, there is a, if you are interested in genealogy of American populist rights, there is a line going from Joseph McCarthy, Roy Cohn, Richard Nixon, Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, Ronald Reagan, and over to Mr. Trump.
Acclaimed Iranian-Danish filmmaker Ali Abbasi directs The Apprentice, which opens today in theaters around the country and the world. The film stars Sebastian Stan as Donald Trump, Jeremy Strong as Roy Cohn, Strong's famous for starring in the Succession TV series, and Maria Bakalova, who plays Trump's first wife, Ivana. The film also deals with Ivana's allegations that Trump raped her. Trump's lawyers have sent Ali Abbasi a cease and desist.